Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
My guest today practiced dentistry in the San Francisco Bay Area for 35 years and is currently a consultant to the Dental Board of California. He's retired now and lives in Chico. Mike Paul began flying in 1978 and has logged over 3,500 hours with a commercial instrument license. Every day for 20 years, he had lunch at a small airport diner in San Carlos, California, where local pilots gather to exchange friendship and conversation. And in 2011, he published a collection of 12 true stories called Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe. He has now written a mystery novel whose hero is not a lawyer, ex-cop, or medical examiner, but a dentist. The story of this unlikely detective is Flight of Betrayal. Mike Paul, welcome.
Thank you.
Now, your first book, Sky Kitchen Cafe, were a collection of true stories, and you had a good bit of success with this book. And in fact, copies of your book are in Washington, D.C., aren't they?
They're in the gift shop at the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum and another Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., yes.
And I can understand why they would be interested in these stories. One in particular is just plays out like a Hollywood movie. And it's a story of these two gentlemen pilots from World War II.
Right. That story is titled The Pilot and the POW. Actually, one of the characters, the true characters, was a pilot. The other was a navigator. And they were stationed in the South Pacific. And one of them, the navigator, Hap, crashed his plane in Japan, was taken prisoner. And 3 months later, the other character, the pilot, was dropping bombs over Tokyo while the navigator was in prison. And they never knew each other until they met 50 years later at this little diner called the Sky Kitchen Cafe. And I was lucky enough to be there when they met.
I can just imagine that you're sitting there and these two guys discover that they were, one might have killed the other. I mean, it's conceivable that that could have happened.
As a matter of fact, the bombing raid that the pilot was on turned out to create the biggest firestorm ever created by man, where 17 square miles of Tokyo was burned. And it burned right up to the door of the prison where the navigator, the POW, was stationed at that time. And again, they, of course, didn't know each other. And the really compelling part of that story is how they met and where they met.
But, you know, then the postscript I found was interesting, too, because these two guys went back to Japan all these years later.
They did, and especially Hap, the prisoner of war. He had a very difficult time after the war. He would have nightmares every night. He would be screaming in hotel rooms. It affected his marriage, his entire life. He finally decided he had to go back to Japan and meet the man who actually he didn't shoot the plane down, but he spared Hap's life when he parachuted out of the B-29.
He was a Japanese pilot who could have killed him.
He was on a mission to kill this, to kill our prisoner of war, Hap, but he chose to spare his life. So Hap did go back to Japan and was able to find him, and they created a friendship. Actually, Hap was at his funeral.
Hollywood couldn't write a better story than that.
Well, I don't know. We'll have to see about that.
My guest is retired dentist Mike Paul, and he has written a novel, Flight of Betrayal. And on the cover of this novel, there's a guy who has, one is dressed in a dentist coat, and the other is dressed in a pilot's jacket. Because your hero in this story does both. He is a dentist and he is a pilot. And I was interested in why you decided to write this novel. Tell us why.
Well, I was hoping you'd ask me that question. I really felt a need to create this character. Our protagonist's name is Brett Raven, and he is a dentist. And I realized a long time ago that the dental profession was in desperate need of a fictional hero. because dentists have been represented many times in books and movies, but they always appear in one of two categories, either a sadist or villain or a buffoon. Examples of that would be if you remember The Marathon Man, where Laurence Olivier was the dentist and was drilling a hole through Dustin Hoffman's front tooth, without anesthesia, of course, in order to make him divulge some secrets. And in The Little Shop of Horrors, the dentist was a sadist who had trouble fulfilling his needs because he was working on a masochist. So that was one genre. The other one is like in MASH, the series where the dentist was really a boob and could never really accomplish anything. And, of course, lately in Hangover, the popular movie of a year or two ago, the dentist was so stupid that he actually pulled out his own tooth. So I said, we've got to get somebody like Brett who can give a little better image to the field of dentistry.
You know, of that list, I might add another one. There, in 1985, there was a movie with Susan Sarandon called Compromising Positions. And in the story, there was a dentist who was a philanderer and got murdered. And your hero is the farthest thing from a womanizer that I can imagine. He's very loyal to one woman. So your depiction of this dentist is nothing like we see typically in the books and movies.
Well, I'm glad that came through.
So why don't we meet this dentist, this Dr. Raven? Why don't you, if you would, read just the beginning of your chapter. We're in the dentist's office here.
The receptionist picked up the phone on the first ring. Dr. Raven's office, this is Ginger. Ginger, it's Annie. I have to talk to Brett right away. It can't wait. Ginger responded to the urgency in her voice. Hold on, Annie. I'll get him. Brett was in the treatment room finishing up on his last patient of the day when he spotted Ginger signaling him. He slipped off his gloves and took the note from her hand. He read it, pulled down his mask, and turned to his assistant. Janet, would you help Mrs. Granger rinse? I have to take a call. He closed the door to the private office, pushed the lighted button on the phone panel, and picked up the receiver. Annie, what's wrong? Annie's voice was shaking. Brett, JT is dead. He crashed the plane on the way home from a fishing trip in Baja. Brett could taste the bile in his throat rising from the knot in his stomach. Oh, God, I'll be right over. JT had been Brett's best friend until he married Annie, Brett's ex-wife. They were still able to remain partners in the twin-engine Beechcraft Baron, which they flew out of San Carlos, an airport located 30 miles south of San Francisco. JT had been a pilot 10 years longer than Brett, and he had been the one who had encouraged him to take up flying. He knew everything there was to know about flying and everything there was to know about their airplane. Brett was incredulous that JT could crash the Baron.
This is my guest, Mike Paul, reading from his novel, Flight of Betrayal. And this is a novel. It's fictional, but there's a lot of truth in that. You, for example, are a dentist, so you know when you're talking about what a dentist does in his office, typically we know we can say, yeah, that sounds just like what a dentist might do.
Well, it's interesting. Part of this, this isn't a monument to the field of dentistry, but I did try in the book to show people a little insight into the back room of dentistry and to show them how hard dentists work and how dedicated they are and how ethical they are. So that's a small aspect of the book.
I think it's also a tribute to people like the receptionist Ginger, because she's kind of a hero in the story, I found.
Ginger is a very good character, and oddly enough, when I practiced dentistry, my receptionist's name was Ginger. I don't know how that name came up, but that might not have been accidental.
So we have a receptionist named Ginger who helps hold things together at the office, and then we have this character, JT, who is a pilot, and you say they flew out of San Carlos, and we already know from your first book that you are very familiar with this airport in San Carlos and this little diner there that's a real place. So there is some real-life information in there. I'm guessing, though, that JT is pretty fictional.
Well, really, all these characters are fictional. Some of my friends, when they read the first few chapters, thought it was autobiographical. But as you read through and you get to the second or third or fourth chapter, you realize that it really isn't me. I almost wish that it were, but it isn't. But a lot of the places I used in the San Francisco Peninsula are real places, and people from that geographical area have gotten a kick out of reading about familiar areas and places.
And that's what injects this realism in the story, is that those of us who are familiar with the Bay Area know that, yes, these are real places, and so it seems like this could be a real story. But now, we've just learned that there was an airplane crash. So this is a way that you can tell a story, a dramatic story, because airplanes, by the nature of people who fly them, dramatic things happen. And in this case, a crash, and somebody has died that your character knows. Now, what is one of his concerns is, well, first of all, he doesn't know how this could possibly happen. And what does he suspect that the National Transportation Safety Board is going to say caused it? On page 13, you talk about this dentist is trying to figure out, make sense of this tragedy.
Yeah, I think we may be on a different page here.
This is page 13 that I was... when you were saying that they're going to investigate the tragedy, but...
Yeah, well, it reads that Brett's brain was working overtime trying to make sense out of this tragedy. He knew pilot error was the number one cause of most airplane accidents. Mechanical failure, the fear which most passengers harbor, was a distant second. It would be months before the NTSB, the National Transportation Safety Board, would finish its investigation and write its report. Brett also knew that often when no obvious cause was found, the board would assume pilot error and close the case.
So that is one thing that brings your main character, Brett, into this adventure, because this is a friend of his, or at least they had been close friends, and he has died. And they were at least partners in owning this plane. So he's thinking, okay, they're going to investigate the story, but they're likely just going to say, blame the pilot, and we can close the case.
Right. He's afraid there's going to be a whitewash, and he wants to know what really happened, because he just couldn't believe that this man, JT, his partner, who was such a fine pilot, could have just crashed a plane in daylight conditions with no bad weather.
And I'm assuming that this that you cite here is true, that the number one cause of pilot accidents is pilot error, and that you mentioned in your story that the mechanical failure, which is what most passengers are afraid of, was a distant second.
That is all true. That is true, yes.
So that's probably what Brett is saying. I don't want this to be the case. If the NTSB is going to say it was pilot error, I don't believe this, so I'm going to have to do a little investigating myself.
Well, you're getting a little ahead of the story, but yes, that's exactly what happens.
Well, then why don't we go back, instead of going ahead in the story, why don't we go back in the story to 1976?
Okay. Well, in 1976, this is when Brett starts college, and where he meets... I guess we'd call her our heroine in the story. Let me just read it to you. In 1976, Brett was a freshman at UC Berkeley. During a Friday night fraternity party, he and his roommate Rob were perched on the staircase, eyeing the door and checking out the female talent. Rob spotted a prospect. How about that one with the tight blue sweater? Not my type. Too sexy looking, Brett replied. Man, you're picky. How about the tall one with all the jewelry? Ooh, too hard-looking. Rob was running out of patience. There's a prospect, the cute one with the short hair and the neat figure. Brett turned his head toward the direction in which Rob was looking. Once he spotted her, he couldn't take his eyes off her. He could tell she was only about 5 feet tall and didn't weigh more than 100 pounds. She glanced in his direction, and Brett gave her a big smile. Her green eyes lit up, and she smiled back. See you later, Rob, Brett said as he headed in her direction. Brett moved toward the door and intercepted her as she picked up her name tag. Hi, I'm Neil Diamond. Welcome to my concert. Her smile turned into a full-fledged laughter as she thrust out her hand. Nice to meet you, Neil. I'm Annie Frazier.
My guest is Mike Paul, and he's reading from his novel, Flight of Betrayal. And you said that when friends read the book, they said, oh, that's autobiographical. So I'm assuming from that maybe you actually went to Berkeley?
I did.
And that maybe you met your wife at Berkeley?
Well, coincidentally, that may be the case. And I just want to say, of course, we always write about something which we know about. And so this book has been written about things I know about. And the beginning of the book, of course, is just kind of patterned after a short period of my life. But as I said before, it takes off from there in a very different direction.
Well, I was reading it too, trying to separate fact from fiction, because I knew some of it, like I mentioned, was true. And so I was guessing that, yeah, this part is probably, you probably were a student at Berkeley. And I don't know if it was 1976, but you have your character meet his, and we already know that they're going to get married because early in the first chapter, you refer to her as his ex-wife. So we know they get married, but we don't know how did they. Why didn't it last? Well, we have a third character that you've already mentioned, and he goes by the initials JT. So we know how Brett and Annie met. How did Brett meet JT?
Okay, well, let me tell you how Brett and actually Annie met JT. Brett met JT in the spring of 1989. By the way, this is not my time frame. I wish I were in this time frame, but I'm 20 years way before this.
And I might mention that you are reading. We've gotten now to chapter 4 in your book. So read that section.
Right. This is the beginning of chapter 4. Brett met JT in the spring of 1989, 5 years after he had gone into practice. A brochure arrived in the mail from Talbot Financial, a consulting firm specializing in financial planning and investments. A free seminar was planned at the Hyatt Regency in Burlingame, a few miles north of Brett's office. He reserved a spot for both himself and Annie. The speaker at the seminar was John Thomas Talbot, the owner of the firm. Brett and Annie immediately took a liking to him. He was a handsome guy, about 10 years older than Brett, with a charismatic personality. Standing about 6'3", Talbot was a good 5 inches taller than Brett, and in contrast to Brett's dark features, he had blue eyes and wavy blonde hair. Although Talbot displayed an impressive physical presence, it was his demeanor which captured his audience. He was organized, confident, and believable. His philosophy of financial planning and investing was different from any of the other speakers Brett and Annie had previously heard. Talbot didn't try to sell the audience stocks or bonds or life insurance. Instead, he talked about goals. Where do you want to be in 10 years, 20 years, and 30 years from now? And how can he help you get there? He talked about levels of risk and the importance of an investor to be able to sleep at night without worry. After listening to him for 45 minutes, Brett thought that John Thomas Talbot might be the smartest guy he had ever heard.
And this is ex-dentist and pilot Mike Paul reading from his novel, Flight of Betrayal. And we've just learned that the main character, Brett, and his wife think that John Thomas Talbot is a very smart man. So this also adds to how could such a smart man have crashed an airplane? So we begin to wonder, too, just as Brett is wondering, because this is a character who, in the very first chapter, we know that he has died and that he crashed a plane. I hesitated that we know that he's died because Brett maybe doesn't know. He doesn't know much of anything. So this is why he wants to investigate the whole situation. And you mentioned the backgrounds of JT compared to Brett and Annie, and how were their backgrounds different?
Well, Brett and Annie grew up in a middle-class home. JT grew up in a very poor home, and one of his goals in life was never to be poor again. So he got a scholarship to Stanford, as we read in the book, and he became this financial expert. So he was a very smart guy, and he was very concerned about always being successful.
And Annie's father was a lawyer, and I was wondering, is your father-in-law a lawyer?
you know, now we're getting too autobiographical. maybe, Nancy.
Okay. But I'm still, you know, your friends are thinking, oh, he's writing an autobiography here. But of course, that's in the early parts of the book, because we know then that the adventures really start to, or the mystery starts to compound. And you introduce some rather unsavory characters. And tell us who Claude is.
Well, Brett takes on the task of trying to figure out for Annie, who is now the widow of JT, as a favor to her, because he's very fond of her. He takes on the task of checking out the financial status of JT when he died. And in looking through his files, he comes across a very strange note. And it was from a man named Claude Jennings. And Brett decides it's in the interest of this little investigation of his that he meets Claude. So in this little sequence is the first time he comes to Claude's office to meet him. And he says, Claude didn't fit the image Brett had pictured in his mind. Claude was about 50 years old, but he was probably taken for 60 with his bald head and pot belly. His face was puffy and his nose was a reddish color, giving the impression that he drank too much. It looked as if he had shaved that morning, but he'd missed the entire section under his chin where stubble was still visible. He wore an old pair of khakis that were unpressed and a sports shirt, which was decorated with a piece of the scrambled egg he apparently had eaten for breakfast.
So we meet one of these rather unsavory characters, as I just mentioned. I mean, his description leads us to believe, this might be a shady character here.
Could be. You never know.
Well, in your story, Brett has a blue Porsche. And you say it was built in 1965. And I was particularly interested in that because my brother had a Porsche in the 1960s. And so I emailed my brother and said, was your Porsche maybe a 1965? And he said, no, actually, it was built in 67. It was a 68 model. And so I was enjoying that and thinking
of my
brother.
Different model. Different
model. Oh, it was? Yeah. But maybe you know so well because you had one?
Maybe.
My guest is Mike Paul, who is a retired dentist and a pilot. You still fly.
I do.
So
mm-hmm.
You're still currently a pilot. And because you know these two professions well, you have fashioned a story that where the dentist is a hero. And he's investigating this friend who crashed in the airplane that they own together. And in Chapter 11, you have Brett opening the doors to the hangar for the first time since his partner, JT, died. Would you read that section of your book?
Sure. Brett hadn't opened the hangar, hadn't opened the doors to the hangar since JT's death. He dialed in the combination, removed the padlock, and slid the doors open. It was a lonely feeling. The Baron was destroyed, and JT was dead. He really had no reason to be there, but he looked around and found everything was still neatly arranged as he had left it, except for the right back corner. The rear four seats of the Baron had been removed and were haphazardly shoved into the corner. Brett visualized the Baron without rear seats. There would have been an empty hold inside the double side doors, which could accommodate a huge amount of cargo. More space than JT would have needed for a fishing trip to Punta Pescadero. Brett knew he had to go down to Baja. There were too many strange circumstances surrounding both JT's trip to Mexico and his fiery crash coming back.
So now we know that this crash was when JT was returning from Mexico. And supposedly he went down for a fishing trip. But this now Brett is wondering, was this really a fishing trip? Because this looks rather suspicious.
It does look suspicious, and as we move on, of course, we find out why.
So let's go to the part where Brett is in Mexico, and this is scary enough because nowadays, the police in Mexico, if they decide they don't like the color of your eyes, they can throw you in jail. So they are not to be messed with. And there's a section in your book where Brett is being followed by a couple of policeman. Why don't you read that section of your book?
Okay, let me just set real quickly. There's another character in this sequence. His name is Manny. And Brett was worried about his safety when he went down to Baja. He had done this once before, and it didn't end successfully. So he took a petty gangster with him, a fellow named Manny, who ends up to be
a little muscle along the way.
Yeah, it's a little backup. So they're being chased, and they're headed back to Punta Pescadero, where their airplane is located. Brett looked behind them. Two headlights and a flashing red one were closing quickly on them. Manny floored the accelerator. The tires peeled rubber as the Mustang sprang forward, and in 20 seconds, the speedometer was reading 105. The lights behind them disappeared, but 5 minutes later, they reappeared and were getting larger. Manny switched off his lights. It was still 30 miles to Punta Pescadero, and at the speed they were traveling, it would take another 20 minutes. Manny glanced at the rearview mirror. Rivera's car was slowly gaining on them. How long would it take to get the engine started on the plane, Manny said. If everything works, about 5 minutes. Is the gate we use the only one to the runway? Yeah, that's how they keep it secure. It was pitch black, and Manny was having trouble keeping the Mustang off the shoulder. I'm going to put you right at the gate. Start the engines and pull it on the runway. I can hold them off for 5 minutes, and then I'll make a run of the plane and we're out of here. He took the pistol from his pocket and placed it on the console.
So already, if we're reading this, our heart's starting to beat faster. Are they going to make it? Because these police are serious. And so Manny's going to drive him right up, but it's going to take him 5 minutes to get the plane cranked up. So go ahead and read some more of that.
Manny knew they were getting close. He slowed down to 60 and turned the headlights back on. The police car saw the lights and closed to within 300 yards. A sign, "Bienvenido a Punta Pescadero," was illuminated by the Mustang's headlights. Manny hit the brakes, took a 90-degree right, and floored it down the dirt road to the lodge. The Mustang skidded to a stop in front of the airport gate. Brett grabbed the two overnight cases, jumped out of the car, and headed for the airplane. 5 minutes, Manny yelled. While Brett was dialing the code to enter the gate, Manny positioned himself between the Mustang and the airport. Brett scurried through the gate, propped it open with a rock, and reached the plane at the same time the police car came racing down onto the property. Brett hurriedly untied the ropes that were securing the Baron to the blacktop, unlocked the plane, and slid into the pilot's seat. Normally, he used a checklist prior to starting the engines, but today he relied on his memory.
So here we have these characters who are racing to the plane trying to beat the policeman. And you remember the old Saturday matinees where we stopped? They were hanging on the cliff. So we're going to stop right there with this cliffhanger. And thank you very much, Mike Paul.
Thank you.
You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, kcho.org. I'm Nancy Wiegman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.